our culture that revolves around the whale would no longer be the same.
Alaskans protest Shell's Arctic drilling plan on the Exxon Valdez anniversary. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, March 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a state House committee passes a bill aimed at seizing land from the federal government.
I'm not afraid of a fight. I'm not afraid of doing what I think is right.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
It's the 26th anniversary of America's second largest oil spill when an Exxon tanker leaving Valdez Arm ran aground, leaking at least 11 million gallons of North Slope crude into Prince William Sound. In Washington, D.C., environmental activists marked the occasion with a demonstration in front of the White House. Their message was less about Exxon and tanker safety than it was about Shell and its plan to drill in the Chukchi Sea. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Hey Obama, yes you can! Stop Shell Oil's dirty plan!
Dozens of people gathered at lunchtime outside the White House fence. They carried big photos of oiled animals and signs that say "Oil Kills" and "I Heart Arctic." No one wore a polar bear suit. But there was a girl cocooned in a giant sandpiper costume. She says she's Lizka Bessinier of Anchorage.
I'm 15 years old. I'm a freshman at Service High School.
Many of the demonstrators work at Washington-based environmental groups. Others, like the sandpiper, were in the Capitol for Wilderness Week, an annual campaign on Capitol Hill to advance environmental priorities. One speaker at the megaphone was Allison Warden, an Inupiaq performance artist with roots in Koktovik.
How much is a culture worth?
Priceless.
My people will no longer be Inupiaq because we won't be able to live off the land and off the water in the way that we have been. So every single one of you listening here, it's important for you to stand up.
Inupiaq leaders, including North Slope Borough Mayor Charlotte Brower, were just in Washington arguing for Arctic development, including oil drilling in the Arctic Refuge. But Warden says the people she talks to are worried that drilling offshore will disrupt the whale migration, particularly if there's a spill.
It would permanently change our relationship to the ocean and to the animals, and they would, you know, be in a different state, and our culture that revolves around the whale would no longer be the same.
Shell has said it wants to return to drill in the Chukchi Sea this summer, but it has several legal and logistical hurdles to clear. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is expected to announce within the week its record of decision on Lease Sale 193, which includes Shell's leases in the Chukchi. Assuming the leases are reaffirmed, it's not the final green light.
Shell still needs to get an exploration plan approval and the permits that are associated with that.
That's Peter Van Tine, an Anchorage environmental lawyer and, incidentally, the father of the giant sandpiper girl. Van Tine is closely following Shell's permitting process on alert for flaws.
The exploration plan should be a major hurdle, absolutely, because there are such fundamental challenges to drilling in the Arctic, and that's the place where those specific challenges need to be addressed in the permitting scheme.
Shell has repeatedly said it won't resume its Arctic drilling program unless it's sure it can do so safely and responsibly. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A bill with the goal of seizing federal land is now one step away from a vote on the House floor. House Speaker Mike Chenault introduced the bill after President Barack Obama announced his intention to permanently ban drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
I'm not afraid of a fight. I'm not afraid of doing what I think is right.
The intent of the bill is to take the 5.5 million acres of land owed to Alaska from the Alaska Statehood Act and then some at a hearing in the House Finances Committee on Monday. Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra questioned whether such legislation would stand.
This bill
takes away 168 million acres, way more than what's owed to us. The legislative legal memo that's been given to your office says, quote unquote, the bill is unconstitutional. I've still looked and not found a single provision of the federal constitution that allows us to take land from the federal government.
Guerra pointed out that a similar bill that passed in Utah is estimated to cost the state $2 million in litigation, and that former Arizona Governor Jan Brewer, a conservative Republican, vetoed such legislation because she did not believe it could be enforced. The state administration is unsure whether Alaska would benefit if the legislation could be enforced. A memo from the Department of Natural Resources noted it could increase Alaska's oil, gas, and mineral holdings, but another analysis also found that the cost of managing more acreage could be significant, and that the state could also receive contaminated lands as a result. The bill moved out of House Finance Committee with support from all but one Republican. The committee did remove a provision that would have included national parks like Denali in the seizure. The Alaska House has fired its latest salvo at Governor Bill Walker in an ongoing dispute over a gas line. The body passed a bill to keep him from pursuing an alternative to the Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Project yesterday, ignoring a veto threat from the governor. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
At the most basic level, the fight is about how to deal with the oil and gas industry. On one side, you have the House majority, led by Speaker Mike Chenault, who emphasized partnership as a way to get a gas line built from the North Slope to Tidewater. And on the other, you have the governor and the Democratic minority, who take a more oppositional tack with the producers. Representative Craig Johnson, an Anchorage Republican, said as much on the House floor on Monday night when advocating for the Speaker's bill.
We can send a very clear message to our partners that we are their partners and we're not their opponents, that we together can get this done.
Johnson likened the bill to putting the genie back in the bottle. The legislation blocks Governor Bill Walker from taking a smaller contingency project known as the Alaska Standalone Pipeline, or ASAP, and scaling it up so it could be a direct substitute for the large diameter Alaska Liquefied Natural Gas Project. Republican leadership worry the proposal could jeopardize the work that's being done on AKLNG. But Walker, along with Democrats in the House, think the plan could serve as a bargaining chip. Representative David Guttenberg of Fairbanks said it would increase the state's negotiating power and put the state in a better position if negotiations with industry fall apart.
By having a fallback quasi-competing project that's in place, if the AKLNG fails, if somebody pulls out, if it's not economical, then we'll have something real in place, not something we know it's not enough volume.
The bill ultimately passed 24-14, with Republicans Paul Seaton and Jim Culver joining the Democratic minority in opposition. Culver, whose district includes the Richardson Highway, offered two unsuccessful amendments to route a gas line through that corridor. Democrats offered no amendments. The governor has already announced he would veto the bill if it makes it to his desk, calling it un-Alaskan in a February press conference. Overriding a veto requires an affirmative vote from at least 40 of the legislature's 60 members. Leadership of the Senate's 15-member majority has signaled support for the House bill. In Juneau, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Saxman residents petition to restore their rural subsistence designation.
We've noticed a downward drift of civic apathy. It is vital and essential to restore the rural status of Saxman.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Registration is open for the Alaska Trails 2015 Trails Conference, April 23rd to the 25th in Wasilla. Agenda and more information at alaska-trails.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Trails.
More than $1 million originally planned for Anchorage bike infrastructure in 2012 is now being allocated for use on other road projects instead. KSKA's Ann Hillman has the details.
Back in 2012, more than 125 people wrote to AMATS asking for more money to be put toward building things like bike lanes and putting up signs to make the city safer. AMATS is Anchorage Metropolitan Area Transportation Solutions, the federally funded group that's responsible for transportation projects in the Muni. $1 million had already been set aside for the design. Advocates convinced AMATS to add another $1.3 million to that. The state's Department of Transportation was supposed to obligate that $1.3 million for project design by September of 2014. They didn't. DOT project manager David Post says the department was running late in finding a project manager to do the design work. Once they found one, he says they thought the original $1 million was enough.
And I think they've got plenty of money to go ahead and keep them moving forward, you know, at the rate that they're progressing.
The money is enough to design 10 to 12 bike infrastructure projects. The bike plan includes nearly 300. They range in size from painting stripes on the side of the road to designate a bike lane, all the way up to building new off-road bike trails. Some of the projects are already elements of larger transportation projects. DOT spokesperson Jill Reese.
And so we went ahead and deobligated that money and or let it go on to other projects. It's really difficult to trace down what those projects are, but that's sort of beside the point.
This decision was made in September. It was included in a report to AMATS, but never publicly highlighted or discussed. However, minutes from the November 2014 AMATS Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee detail comments from DOT representatives that say the full $2.3 million had already been obligated for bike plan implementation. Brian Littmans is president of Bike Anchorage and is a member of the Bicycle and Pedestrian Committee. He discovered that the money had been removed from the bike project. He says the move is a major setback for implementing the bike plan because more design work would have made more projects ready for construction funding.
DOT referred to it as, quote, a little snafu, and I find that unfortunate, especially when we are lacking bicycle infrastructure in the city. We only have 10 miles of bike lanes, and most other cities that have the number of bicyclists we do have much more bicycle infrastructure, and as a result, their cities are much safer than ours.
City Transportation Planning Manager Craig Lyon said he did not know that the money was moved until recently and that DOT has never previously mentioned that they did not need the $1.3 million for design work. He says he's trying to locate pots of money left over from completed projects to put toward the bike plan, but ultimately it's up to the AMATS Policy Committee to commit funds. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Bering Sea crab fishermen are trying to get through as much Bear Dyke tanner quota as they can before the season ends next week. This year's huge allocation put the fleet in a time crunch, and future seasons could bring much of the same, more of the same. That's thanks in part to a new preferred size for the species. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more.
Crab fishermen are legally allowed to keep any Bear Dyke tanner crab over 4.8 inches. But their quota is based on something else, the size of crab that they prefer to sell. Last week, the State Board of Fisheries unanimously agreed to change the preferred size limit for Bear Dyke in the fishery's eastern district near Bristol Bay. It's now 5 inches instead of 5.5. Ruth Christensen works for Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers, the co-op that devised the change. She says the industry started making this switch a couple of years back when Bear Dyke reopened after years of off-and-on closures. The transition, she says, started with the harvesters.
If we retain this crab, will you accept it and can you sell it? And processors said yes. And to my knowledge, Over the last two seasons, there hasn't been a processing company that hasn't accepted the 5-inch crab.
Now it'll be part of how fishery managers set the quota for Barredi. Doug Pengilly is a crab research coordinator for the Department of Fish and Game.
It's how the total allowable catch is set. What the harvest strategy assumes is the size of retention.
He says the new assumption could increase the quota by as much as 23%. That could mean a lot of Barredi on the table going forward, and this year's high quotas have already put fishermen to the test. Frank Kelty is the natural resources analyst for the city of Unalaska. With Barredi on the rise, he thinks busier seasons could be the new normal.
We're facing a crunch because the closure date for the Barredi fisheries is March 31st. So if you have snow crab quotas that are large, you have part of the crab fleet that's got to do pot cod, and then you have a Barredi season, it's really crunch time to get it. So I think you can see more effort in October and November and fishing into December on Barredi, trying to get the majority of that product before the first of the year when snow crab and other fisheries are taking place.
This year, high quotas meant the over 60-foot pot boat fleet, which normally spends January on Pacific cod, stayed focused on crab. That's pushed cod season almost 2 months past its normal end date, and it's put some of Unalaska's processors in a crunch of their own as they try to juggle species that don't often overlap. Those processors are also worried that the size change for Barredi could create overlap at the grocery store. Don Goodfellow, the plant manager for Alyeska Seafood, says a 5-inch Barredi is too close in size to a big snow crab. He thinks it'll make it harder for consumers to tell the difference between the species and easier for vendors to cut prices on Barredi. Goodfellow and others voted to oppose the size change at Unalaska's Fish and Game Advisory Committee, but the measure wasn't controversial when it passed at the Board of Fish. Frank Kelty thinks it's good news. He says Barredi is facing some market uncertainty right now after years of instability, but he thinks higher quotas will help fix that.
If we have some years, steady years, where we have some decent quantities of product, I think that market niche for Barredi will come back again.
The crab fleet got through all 8.4 million pounds of Eastern District Barredi quota this year, but they might not finish their 6.6 million pounds of quota in the West. At the rate they're going, Kelty anticipates the fleet will leave a million pounds of Barredi in the water this year. He thinks the industry might lobby to extend the season in the future. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The men and women of Public Employees Local 71 keep the haul road and thousands more miles of Alaska highways clear of snow and sleet in winter and safe for travel in the summer. 2,500 members strong with 74 workstations across Alaska. Public Employees Local 71, working hard for Alaska, working hard for you. This message is sponsored by Public Employees Local 71.
An Ojibwe woman and independent journalist recently visited Alaska for a series of stories on historical trauma and Native American health, mental health practices. As KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports, Mary Annette Pember says the troubled lives of Native Americans reflect their troubled history.
In one of her articles, Mary Annette Pember tells the story of Osira. In 1944, at the age of five, she was removed from her home in a Bristol Bay area village and sent to a Catholic boarding school in Interior, Alaska. There, Osira says she and her sister joined dozens of other children in a strictly regimented life of hard work, harsh punishment, and little schooling. Pember says her interest in historical trauma has its roots in her own family history. Like Osira, Pember's mother was removed from her Wisconsin family as a child.
My mother was a boarding school survivor. She's passed on now. But, you know, as I began this whole looking at historical trauma some years ago, as I kind of wanted to look at myself and my own family's dis-ease and our struggles that we've had with substance abuse and just, you know, mental health issues.
Pember says the history of Native Americans is one of overwhelming trauma, such as widespread death from war and disease, dislocation from their homelands, and removal of children from their families.
So there's a lot of hurt, there's a lot of pain, and, you know, as humans, I think it's a pretty normal response to want the pain to go away. And I think that's kind of what folks are doing.
Dr. Dewey Ertz of Rapid City, South Dakota, visited Alaska last fall to speak at a conference on substance abuse hosted by the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association. He's a member of the Cheyenne River Lakota, survivors of a notorious massacre.
People who not only defeated Custer with the Battle of Little Bighorn, but were also the victims at Wounded Knee.
During his 40 years as a psychologist, Ertz has treated trauma survivors and conducted research about trauma. He says people's reactions vary depending on the type of trauma and the individual, their support system, and resilience. But Ertz says many people find ways to numb overwhelming emotions.
One very commonly is addictions or substances, including food. Another one is anger, because anger is a secondary emotion and covers up other emotions very effectively. Another is bad relationships, because if you're in bad relationships, you have somebody else to blame for everything. And the last one actually is sex. Now, people are not numb during sex, but that's all they're thinking about.
And Ertz says some people use more than one of those numbing techniques.
And then you have gladiators who say, if one thing is good to numb with, I will use O4. So they partner up with someone that they can drink or use drugs with, have a bad relationship with, be angry at, have sex with, and that produces lots of children.
Ertz says children learn these adverse maladaptive coping mechanisms from their parents and later model them for their children. He says there's also now a theory that trauma alters the way genes express themselves. He says the idea behind epigenetics is that in the right or wrong environment, a person may be predisposed to unhealthy psychological reactions. Still, Ertz says healing is possible, therapy helps, and in an article published March 16th, Pember describes the success of a Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation program headed by Rose Dominic that uses ancient Yupik traditions in healing. Pember says healing occurs when survivors of trauma are in a safe environment and can share their story.
I think awareness, you know, is a big deal. And, you know, one of the things that Rose Dominic and her team talked about is, you know, laying it all out on the table, you know, on what maybe you're dealing with, if it be substance abuse or if you were sexually abused as a child, and really just talking about it and taking a look at it helps you gain a little bit of perspective on it.
Pember says that sharing helps people understand they're having a normal human reaction to repeated or prolonged stress, and they can learn to behave and respond differently. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
The Southeast Alaska Subsistence Regional Advisory Council met in Saxman and in Sitka last week to discuss and gather input on issues related to subsistence in the region, including a proposed change to the rural designation process. That change could make a big difference to Saxman, which has been considered non-rural since 2007 for the purpose of federal subsistence rights. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
Many Saxman residents packed a meeting held at that village's community center. That was expected. Somewhat less expected was the number of Saxman residents and their supporters who also spoke during the subsistence meeting in Sitka the very next day. Sylvia Bainey is the mayor of the city of Saxman. She says that the loss of subsistence rights has negatively affected the people living in her village.
So we've noticed a downward drift, a civic apathy. However, today, a much more beautiful reality can be ours. It is vital and essential to restore the rural status of Saxman.
Joseph Thomas is a Saxman elder and, like several other speakers, began his comments in Tlingit.
Joseph Thomas. Let me translate to you. My English name is Joseph Thomas. My Tlingit name is Kudeik. I belong to the Tsakwedi tribe, the Killerwhale, and I grew up in Cake.
Thomas says when he first heard the word subsistence, he didn't know what it meant, but his forefathers told him it meant it was going to become harder to gather food. Thomas says that has become the case for Saxman, but he hopes the subsistence board will reverse its decision. Harvey Shields, another Saxman elder, thanked the Sitka tribe for letting him speak on their land. He says gathering food is an important cultural tradition that should be handed down, just like songs and dances.
We took that up on our from our parents and our aunts and uncles, as we did with of putting up our food, our hunting, our fishing, to be able to hand that down as well. And since then, I wasn't able to do that because of the situation we're in right at this time.
The situation started about 15 years ago when the Federal Subsistence Board initiated a review of rural designations. Then in 2006, the board published a proposed rule that would have kept Saxmen rural. But the board eventually decided to vote against that published rule. The organized village of Saxmen immediately asked for reconsideration, which was denied. Last year, OVS filed a lawsuit in federal court over that decision. If the Federal Subsistence Board changes the designation, that lawsuit could be dropped, and that change was encouraged during the SICA hearing by more than just the Saxmen speakers. Former Senator Albert Kukesh of Angoon and former Representative Bill Thomas of Haines also spoke, representing Sea Alaska Corporation. Kukesh told a story about a landslide at Lutuya Bay. He says the trees wondered what happened and wondered how to prevent it from happening again. The trees realized that by holding on to each other by the roots, they could protect each other from a similar fate.
We came to hold hands with Saxmen, and we're asking those of you who are on the committee to hold hands with Saxmen also, because they're your neighbors. They're our neighbors, and everything we do impacts them. If we hold each other up, we're going to be fine.
The proposed subsistence management rule would allow the Federal Subsistence Board more flexibility when deciding which communities should be considered rural for subsistence purposes. Thanks to Rachel Waldholtz in Sitka, who recorded the hearing. I'm Layla Carey, reporting in Ketchikan.
Finally tonight, we have a correction. Last night in a story on funding for water and sewer systems, we reported 4,500 homes in Alaska don't have running water and flush toilets. The correct number is 3,300. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ann Hillman and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Annie Ropeek in Unalaska, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. The 2015 PFD filing season is here. If you have questions about your absences or someone you know away at college or serving in the military, the State of Alaska Department of Revenue encourages you to be proactive. Check out the absence guidelines before applying for your PFD. Visit pfd.alaska.gov and click on eligibility in the banner to learn more. The deadline to apply is March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.